Prescriptions for Health with Dr. Len and Vicky Saputo. Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, January 30th, 2012. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicky Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time and from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are archived on DrSaputo.com and PRN.fm.
And today you're going to hear Vicky's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 22 the hour. And we've got a really good show for you today. It's going to include, is a dog better than having an antidepressant?
And omega-3s like fish oil can prevent and protect against nerve damage, even sciatica.
And what's with the epidemic of mental illness in this country? It seems like it's everywhere.
And can the contrast medium used in cardiac catheterizations and CT scans be harmful to our health?
We got some interesting news that's mainstream, too. Stuff about stem cells helping people with heart attacks. It should be very fascinating to learn this one.
And how can statins cost four times as much in the U.S. as in the U.K.?
All right. So if you want to join our conversation and have some questions about our topics or your health, give us a call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
We've all heard the expression that a dog is man's best friend. Well, I think he's or she can also be a woman's best friend.
Yeah, well, and you're my best friend.
Thank you. Woof, woof.
Yeah, really.
So are dogs better than antidepressants? You know, this is a new study that just came out about how actually dogs can be better than an antidepressant. But, you know, they're certainly loyal and loving and protective and there was an article that just came out. Actually, there were a couple of them. One was about Catherine, what's her name, the actress, Heidel,
that's right.
Yeah, Hagel. Catherine Hagel.
Okay.
And about her dogs and how much joy they brought to her. And then there was another article that came out about this boy that had some unusual metabolic progressive disease. And his dad, who was a policeman, found him a police dog, and it was able to detect when this kid's oxygen levels were too low, and also before he had a seizure, the dog could sense that. We've talked in other shows about how dogs can even sniff for cancer and
they do that diseases. For a lot of things. See, there are thousands of chemicals that come out in the breath, and our olfactory system doesn't match a dog's. It doesn't even come close. In fact, it rivals that of what our spectrophotometers show. And dogs can tell all kinds of different cancers. They're looking at prostate cancer and breast cancer and melanoma.
Lung cancer.
And they can find some of these cancers with about 97% accuracy, which is really amazing because we already know the outcome, and then we can test and see what the dog does.
Well, the other thing that dogs can do for people is that if they have diabetes or a problem like that with their blood sugar,
if it's too high or too low, they can sense it.
The dogs can sense that. Mm-hmm. And even if your blood pressure down.
Well, we all know about people who are blind and people who are deaf. Dogs can do a lot of things to help them, and they do some amazing things to help people who have balance problems. They can support them. They can even pull wheelchairs. I like the idea of bringing dogs into places like convalescent hospitals, you know, extended care facilities, where people are lonely, they don't get much connection, and Fido's there for you all the time. I mean, it's a wonderful thing to do.
You know, people send emails around, you know, joking about it, showing how, you know, the dog, they'll make it like a question, you know, like, who's always there? Who can you,
right.
Who's always happy to see you when you come home and to sleep with you? And even if you're depressed or if you're angry or whatever it is, you know, that your dog's always there. So it might be something to think about. For these service dogs, they're normally pretty expensive. I think they can be like $15,000.
Right.
If a person could afford it and they really did have a disability, it looks like it's something to look into. And also now with this new study talking about how that they really actually change your biochemistry as far as depression goes.
Oh, for sure. I mean, they stimulate all kinds of hormonal releases. They probably modify our neurotransmitter levels, and we feel good. You know, what could be better than being around some person or somebody or some animal that just loves you unconditionally and will be there no matter what happens?
Well, it's interesting that they did studies on it, because we already pretty much know, you know, how you feel if an animal or a person or anybody is so happy to see you and is loving you.
A little attention does a lot, sure.
I mean, I know I feel good when I go out to the ranch and the horses come running when they see me, you know?
I know. It makes
me feel good.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, we all need connection, and a positive connection, loving support, being there when you're in need is a big deal. Sometimes people who have problems, you know, have lost their dog or lost their cat or whatever animal they're close to, even birds.
Oh, it's really
Really challenging. And there are organizations, there are networks on the web that support this kind of thing. I think it's really good that people have a place to go where they can get the support they need from people who understand, because they've gone through the same thing.
Oh, it's real grief. It's real grief. There are other things just to remind people that you can do for depression rather than resorting to taking an antidepressant, like exercising and even talking to a friend. Antidepressant studies have shown that it's more effective than a placebo.
Well, it's
not a placebo. I didn't mean a placebo. It's more effective than taking an antidepressant.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. Well, antidepressants and placebos do about the same thing, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't count, because it's, I mean, whether you get it from a placebo or from a real pill that's got side effects, I mean, the choice there is yours to make. But what we still haven't done in mainstream medicine is come to the place where we actually will rely on using placebo. And, of course, that depends on your relationship with your doctor. Whoever your healthcare practitioner is, you have to have a lot of trust in that relationship if a placebo is going to be, one, ethically the right thing to do, because you don't want to go to somebody that you don't know well or that you don't like or that doesn't understand you and all of a sudden have them using a placebo when you should be using something that's real. But if you've got somebody there who's supporting you, who understands you, that cares about you, will listen to you, then if a placebo were to be used, that would be a wonderful choice, as opposed to using the SSRI antidepressants, which we know are no different than placebo.
You know what else I was thinking? There are some children that have problems, that are unhappy and so forth. And I think it seems like it would be pretty comforting to those children to have a dog. A lot of children sleep with stuffed animals, but boy, the real thing. To lick them and love them and be happy to see them.
I mean, we got these dysfunctional families where kids don't feel loved or important or respected. Always their dog will be there for them, or their cat, maybe the cat, but the dog for sure will be there to support and unconditionally love you. I think that's a big thing. That's why it can be so very traumatic for somebody who's a child who's had a dog that's an old dog that now dies, or it's been in an accident, or something goes wrong.
Right, their best friend.
Yeah, it's your best friend. Always there, always listening. Not dysfunctional in any way, unless somebody's abused the dog. You've got real problems. Anyway, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Well, some of the benefits of omega-3 fatty acids, like in fish oil, have been in the news a lot lately for protecting against many things, like they're good for being an anticoagulant so that you don't get a stroke and a heart attack, to mm-hmm. help to thin your blood a bit, and it's
you
a
know,
healthy
Vicki,
way
that,
to do it.
Take a little aside there for a minute. The effect of essential fatty acids, of fish oil in particular, or krill oil, is really dramatic. And the way you can really be sure of that is to do a live blood cell analysis in somebody who has thick blood. And they have clumps of red cells together and clumps of platelets
together.
Like
when you had your cobalt poisoning.
Exactly, like when I had my cobalt poisoning and I had tremendous hypercoagulation. In fact, we were really worried that I'd have a heart attack or a stroke because of that cobalt poisoning. And when I took a fish oil, or when I did my live blood cell analysis and looked and saw there were hundreds of red cells all clumped together in big clots, that was a scary thing to see. And immediately after that, I take two fish oil capsules. We'd look at the blood about an hour later, and it looked like a normal person's blood. Each one of those cells was separate and floating around like it should be.
And you didn't have to take a drug like Coumadin that can have side effects.
Oh, for sure, like a lot of bleeding. So I know that works, and that we now do a stress test for this. So we're looking to see if people who have coagulation problems, like those who are at risk for atrial fibrillation clots, we'll give them the test where we look at their blood first and see if it's thick and if it's clotty, and then give them some fish oil after that and see if it makes their blood better. And if it does, we know we've done our job. If it doesn't, we add nattokinase to it, which is another plant-derived coagulant that dissolves fibrin that clots together. It's beautiful stuff, much safer than Coumadin. We need some controlled studies. We desperately need to have comparative studies of aspirin, Coumadin, Plavix, Pradaxa, which is the new thing that's out, fish oil or krill oil, nattokinase, all these ginkgo, things of those sorts.
Well, you see, though, usually the people that fund these studies are like the pharmaceutical companies, and they want you to use their drugs. So things that are natural, they're probably not enthusiastic about doing those studies.
Well, see, that's where the National Institutes of Health should come in, because they should be there. They're the organization paid for by who? We the people. And what do we want? What do we the people want? We want data that we can trust. We want to stay in the realm of science. We do not want to be stuck in a system where we're just looking at prescription medications that, of course, are always not natural, because if they are natural, you can't patent them. And this is all about return on investment. So this idea of comparative studies is absolutely essential. It should be done. I am so hacked off with the National Institutes of Health, even though I've got my own research money doing studies on infrared light therapy, and I'm grateful for that. I'm really disappointed that we're not looking at the new cutting edge medicine, the new frontier medicine. What's on the horizon that should be coming into clinical practice and needs to be tested, particularly for things that are safe and not expensive and easy to get. Nobody wants to fund those kinds of projects if they're trying to make money, because they're not going to make much. But if we have the National Institutes of Health doing our research for us, as they should, through the Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, that means they've got to change their budget. Their budget is way too low. They're talking about, you know, a few million dollars that's spent in that, when we should be having billions spent in that.
Well, the thing is that we already know that it works, and we already know that it's safe, but for MDs to, you know, prescribe it instead of a drug, it takes the studies to get their attention.
Well, it's a yes and a no there, Vicki. You're making a good point, because we need the science, but at the same time, we doctors are able to use anything we want on our patients, so long as we don't hurt them, we don't try to distract them from using the mainstream therapies, and as long as we can use them off-label, which means that if a drug is approved for one thing, it can be used for any other use that a physician feels is appropriate, because we know it's already fairly safe, or the FDA supposedly never would have approved it.
Except for that's when it gets dangerous.
Well, it does. It can get dangerous, and that's a real problem. But that's the way we should be functioning.
Well, there are other things that omega-3 fatty acids and fish oils are helpful for, too. Like, for example, they're good antiarrhythmic agents, which means that it helps your heart to beat in a normal rhythm.
It can keep it in a normal state a lot better than a lot of other drugs can. And when you're talking about the really serious kinds of heart rhythm disturbances, like ventricular tachycardia or ventricular fibrillation, fish oil is as effective, according to the studies in the mainstream literature, as the most powerful anticoagulants that we have. And yet nobody thinks about that first.
But it's an antiarrhythmic agent also.
That's what I meant, antiarrhythmic.
You said anticoagulant.
Yeah, I didn't mean that. Thank you for correcting it.
Well, also, these oils and these fats are helpful for cancer and for healthy cell membranes and so forth. But the latest research is showing that these omega-3 fatty acids, like in the fish oil, can protect against nerve damage.
Right. And it can cause repair as well at a much faster rate. So this is a beautiful thing to add to anybody who's got an injury, whether it be a nerve or any other part of the body. It's also great for anti-inflammatory effect. It's got powerful anti-inflammatory effects. So if you've got, say, a painful joint, you should be using a combination of essential fatty acids that I think should be both the omega-3s and 6s. So I use fish oil, and I also use something like evening primrose oil, black currant, or borage oil, which are all gamma-linolenic acid, which are anti-inflammatory omega-6 fatty acids.
Well, they're also good for feeding the brain. There are a lot of nerves that are in the brain that go to the rest of our bodies.
We have a high concentration of essential fatty acids in both brain and heart. So if we're short in them, as 95% of the population is, this has been documented in three studies that were done by the U.S. Department of Agriculture on tens of thousands of people. And in them, what did they find? 95% of Americans are deficient in essential fatty acids. And essential fatty acids are called essential because our bodies can't make them. And if we don't have them, we can't even survive.
Well, no wonder there's so much chronic disease.
Well, that's a part of it. I mean, if everybody had a couple tablespoons of flaxseed oil every day, or they went ahead and took, say, a gram of fish oil and maybe a little bit of evening primrose oil or something like that, we would be in much better health.
But a lot of people are afraid to eat fish because of the mercury.
Well, that's true. But, you know, there are some places now that are beginning to check for mercury levels in individual fish. And
right.
If we demand it, that'll start happening.
And some of the top brands of fish oil, they take the mercury out, too. But, you know,
I'm sure they do.
I was also thinking this would be good for tooth pain.
Sure.
And for sciatica.
Yeah.
A radicular pain from a cervical disc in your neck that goes into your arm.
It will add to it. But if you think you're going to pop in two fish oils and your sciatica is going to go away, and I'm not criticizing what you said because you're absolutely right, but you'll be in for a surprise because it's not going to be likely to take away.
But it's something to add to whatever protocol has been prescribed for you. I mean, even for paralysis.
Well, you have to have them. They're anti-inflammatory. They tend to reduce the time after an injury that injury will stay there and cause pain, and it'll help to repair what's happening faster. When these scientists looked at the sciatic nerves of mice, which they had crushed, okay, in an experiment, those that had high levels of omega-3 fatty acids were able to recover from that injury more quickly and more fully. And that even looked at the not just the sensory problems, meaning the pain, but it looked at the motor problems, which means that their muscle mass, because they maintained that a lot better. So these chemicals or these nutrients that we have are vital to use. They're even important to waterproof the skin, Vicki. If you don't have enough, that's a way to stop that. If you want to moisturize your skin, the first thing to do
start
is make sure
inside.
You get a little bit, start from the inside out with a little bit of fish or krill and some evening primrose oil.
Okay, now the other place where you might have some nerve damage that is a topic that's ours that we like to talk about frequently, and that's if you have neuropathy in your feet. And so we always use the photon stimulator. It's a type of near infrared light that pretty much heals and cures diabetic neuropathy or neuropathy from chemotherapy.
Almost neuropathy from most any cause.
Yes, so this would be a nice thing to add to that therapy, would to have the patients also take fish oil.
See, I'd look at it the other way around because the fish oil is like minuscule in its effect compared to what the infrared light does. See, infrared light has the remarkable ability to work on tissues that are around an area that's been damaged. And when we're around an area that has been damaged, those cells don't work right. So if you've had a stroke, there's something called the peri-infarction area, the area around the stroke that doesn't have good blood supply, and it can be relatively large, and those nerves won't work right. But we're now finding that if you shine light on this near-infrared light at about 850 nanometers, that you increase circulation almost instantly, and a lot of return of function can occur, particularly if you've had a major stroke. I just was reading somebody sent me an email talking about somebody who had lost some of their vision after having a surgical procedure that was probably a complication of the surgery and or the anesthesia, and they're blind now. And so what they're thinking is that this person has ischemia, okay, not enough blood flow to the optic nerve. When you don't have enough blood flow to the optic nerve, you can't see. But if you could restore that, and my suggestion was is I shine a little infrared light there and see what happens, you might restore the whole thing and vision come back. I've seen that happen. So it's a fascinating field. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's first 2020 tip.
I have an oldie but goodie for you that has to do with an old lady.
An old lady that's an oldie.
An old lady, yeah, that's an oldie. So this sweet grandmother telephones St. Joseph's Hospital, and she timidly asks, "Is it possible to speak to somebody who can tell me how a patient is doing?" Well, the operator said, "I'll be glad to help, dear. What's the name and the room number of the patient?" In her tremulous voice, she said, "Norma Finley, room 302. Well, the operator said, "Well, let me put you on hold while I check with the nurse's station for that room." So after a few minutes, the operator comes back to the phone and she says, "I have good news. Her nurse just told me that Norma's doing very well. Her blood pressure is fine. Her blood work just came back normal. And her physician, Dr. Cohen, has scheduled her to be discharged tomorrow." And the grandmother said, "Well, thank you. That's wonderful. I was so worried. God bless you for the good news." Well, the operator says, "Well, you're more than welcome. Is Norma your daughter?" And the grandmother said, "No, I'm Norma Finley in room 302. Nobody tells me shit."
That's just too funny, Vicki.
But, you know, my dad did this when he was in the hospital.
You're kidding.
No, he had broken his pelvis, and he was in a lot of pain. He's lying in bed, and his chest was hurting, and he was calling on the nurses on the call button, and nobody came. And so he called the nurse's station.
Oh, my gosh. And they...
finally came in. Well, you know, he turned out he had blood clots in his lungs.
Oh, my gosh.
And another time he was, during that incident when he was in the hospital, he called the doctor's office. And he talked to the doctor from his hospital bed to ask him to help him out.
Uh-huh. Well, that's great. Those are great stories, and they really tell you a lot about the kinds of problems that we face in medicine today.
What we have to do sometimes to get attention or get information.
Well, that's what it's about to a large extent, because what we have is doctors who are trying to help too many patients and don't have enough time. And so the listening, where's the listening, the deep listening, and the caring, the deep caring, where is that? It tends to take more of a back seat, particularly when we have in this system we have of HMO medicine, where doctors are just overworked, and they have changes of shifts more than maybe they did before. The continuity of care isn't that good, and you wind up with a stranger taking care of you, particularly since the doctors who are now treating people in their offices don't do hospital medicine. We have hospitalists. So you come from the outside, where you may have known your doctor for a lot of years and had a relationship, to go in the hospital. You don't know who you're getting or what's going to happen. It's really frightening.
And they talk around you sometimes, even in your room. They'll just talk over you.
Right. So that's got to stop. Anyway, the lines are open. The number is 888-874-4888. We have a call from John from Eugene, Oregon. Hi, John. You there?
Here I am.
How are you?
Good. I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
Okay. So what's happening?
Well, I have a question. I saw an ophthalmologist recently, and I have elevated intraocular pressure.
All right, so you're at risk for glaucoma.
Right. I passed the vision field test twice, so I don't have glaucoma. But he told me when I come back to see him in the spring for a recheck, that if the IOP is still up, he wants to put me on Timolol. And I don't know much about that.
Yeah, they use the beta blockers a lot to try and reduce the pressure. And for some people, that's the right thing to do. But the tendency is to look at that cutoff point, which is about 20 millimeters of pressure. When it gets above that, the risk for developing glaucoma goes way up.
Right.
But it is not a linear relationship, which means that there will be people who have pressures of 25 or more and will not have changes of glaucoma that will lead to blindness. But the scary part of this is that some people who are a little bit less than that can do it too. So you really need to stay close to your doctor and have them monitor your visual fields and your pressures to see how you're doing clinically.
Mm-hmm. That's how
I would manage it if they were my eyes.
So what do you think about him taking the medicine?
Well, I would follow on a regular basis. I'd see if the pressures are changing, because they may not, or they may start coming down. And you're getting a fair amount of beta blocker in that, believe it or not. that can cause the side effects that a lot of people see, which can be fatigue and just weakness.
I was hoping maybe you could suggest some alternative to timolol.
There are some. They're not very good. I reviewed this topic 4 or 5 years ago, and to be honest with you, I can't remember all the things that were suggested there. So you'd have to do a search on it on Google and see what comes up for you.
Okay.
But off the top, I can't remember. So you should know that there are some things that could be done. They're relatively minor compared to what you could do with the beta blockers. But I wouldn't, and those are reasonable things to consider, John, because they don't have the side effects that the beta blockers do. So you've asked a good question. My memory doesn't serve me well. I'm not an ophthalmologist.
Okay.
So I hope that at least my approval, that means something to you, that you're doing the right thing. And, of course, trying the drops is something you could do if the clinical signs are suggesting that the pressure is causing changes in your eye. But your point is you don't want anything to develop in the first place, and you've got a good point.
Right.
All right. Well, thanks for calling, John. I wish I could give you more specific answers, but I can't at the moment. So I would do the Google search looking at alternatives for treating glaucoma. Okay, thanks. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
You know that expression? Are you crazy?
Sometimes that's right.
But you know, there is a U.S. epidemic of mental illness.
Yeah, for sure.
20% of U.S. adults had mental illness last year. And
20% of the population. Now you're talking about a huge number of people.
That's a lot of people, because this article said 5% had it seriously. Well, 5% is 11.4 million.
We're looking at a lot of people there.
So of 20%, that's a lot of people.
Well, that's one person in five. That's right. Out of 300 million people, that's 60 million people who have mental illness, which means that something is interfering with their life so that they aren't functioning well. And it's really not a big surprise that's that way when you look at the dysfunctional nature of what our culture is like, particularly the family unit.
Well, you know what else is surprising? There's more disability from mental illness than any other disease in this country, and this includes cancer and heart attacks. And people end up also taking a lot of time off work, but the cost of it in 2002, so that was 10 years ago, was $300 billion.
Yeah, well, it's not something that's insignificant. And when you look at the stats in terms of depression, and not just depression, but suicide, you know, 8.5 million people considered suicide. 2.5 million people made plans to kill themselves, and 1 million actually tried it. So we're looking at a fairly substantial number of people that are pretty darn unhappy with life.
Well, this is probably why we see so many ads for antidepressants on TV, but you know, one of the side effects of taking an antidepressant is suicide.
Well, that's true. I mean, there are a lot of side effects.
Which just seems ludicrous.
Even osteoporosis is something that's been raised as related to that, too. And, of course, they don't work any better than a placebo does. And that gets us back to that whole placebo issue again.
So you get a dog.
Well, get a dog, yeah. Well, you know, those
and take a walk, because exercise is good.
Well, you know, those are all adjuncts that help a little. And they're important to do, but we've got to go back and solve the underlying problem for why people are like that in the first place. And we tend not to do that.
Well, the other thing that's good though, is for people to know these statistics, because 18 to 25-year-olds, 30% of them are depressed.
Right. If you're over the age of 50.
Or have mental illness. It's not just depression. It's
mental
illness.
Protected if you're over the age of 50. That drops to less than 15%. And women tend to be more depressed than men. It's like 23% versus 17% in men.
So when we're talking about disability and so forth, a lot of mental illness is coexisting with other diseases as well. So,
well, it's an epidemic, and we need to do something about looking at the reasons for why people get depressed. And it starts in their family life, usually as children, because of the dysfunctional nature of our families. And what family do you know that wasn't dysfunctional? And yet, at the same time, you wouldn't say that every family that has a little bit of dysfunctionality to it is going to result in kids that are going to be depressed. So it's a two-way street there. We can't minimize the importance of depression, and we can't say that if you do a few simple little things like here, take this supplement or this herb or do a little bit of exercise, that you're going to solve your problem very easily. These are all things that take sometimes years to work through the combination of psychotherapy or body work, the somatic psychotherapies that help to identify what the underlying causes are.
You know, we live in such a fast-paced world. Everybody's always in a hurry. And some of the statistics are surprising about how much time people really spend with their kids.
Well, that's really true. Anyway, it's time for a short break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we'll be back taking your calls after a short station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. You know, John called just a few minutes ago, and I couldn't give him really a very good answer about the glaucoma. But during the break, I had some resources that I knew that I had, and so I've looked them up. And I'm just going to share, John, some of those things that can be done for glaucoma, at least in the complementary and alternative medicine field. Things like vitamin A, vitamin B1, vitamin C are all reported to help lower intraocular pressure a little bit. But the data on it is weak, and the actual effects or the amount of effect that it has is not that great. One of the good things that a lot of people talk about is marijuana. You know, there are 400 different chemicals in marijuana that can be really pretty effective at helping people have glaucoma. But again, there's not a lot of mainstream data on this, so it's hard to know. There are a few herbal remedies like ginkgo biloba, which is a great antioxidant, and there's some isolated reports that suggest that. Some people think that meditation and acupuncture and exercise can help. And all I did, John, is go to Google and do the search I told you about, but I'm supposed to know the answers, so I did the search quickly myself, and that's the first thing I suggest. So this was actually an article that comes from the Glaucoma Research Foundation, and there's a doctor who is an ophthalmologist. His name is John Hetherington, who, if you do a little Google on him, you'll get the information that I've just reported to you.
So you said vitamin A, B1, and C,
yeah,
marijuana, ginkgo,
yeah,
meditation, acupuncture, and exercise.
Yeah, there's a few things to do. But, of course, those are not in any detail. So if you want to learn more about the details, do that search I told you about. I hope that helps, John. I hate to not be able to give an answer, but thank God the station break was right there, so it gave me a minute to catch my balance. All right, so you had a couple of things you wanted to bring up, Vicki, on the topic we were just talking about.
Yeah, we were talking about mental illness.
How much there is of it.
Yeah, I just also wanted to mention here that it often leads to substance abuse. Actually, it triples it more if you have mental illness.
Yeah, well, for sure. I mean, a lot of people who have mental illness turn to drugs because the life that they're living needs something that just, quotes, make you feel better. And the idea is to do that because it temporarily does some things that take you out of your misery. But in the long haul, we all know that that becomes problematic and it's not a solution that we should be considering. You need to get help. And finding help is not always so easy. You know, you go to your psychiatrist and maybe you'll be one of those people who's lucky enough to get psychotherapy and it may even work. But all too often what we're using is the drugs to try and solve the symptoms, and I think that's a terrible way to try and solve that problem. So those are all things that relate to mental illness. And, of course, a lot of the time, even people going to the psychiatrist might go for a number of years, know everything about themselves, and still not have worked through their problem because the problem is one that they know about but haven't really dealt with in an emotional way where they've resolved it. That's where the psychotherapies that are related to somatic work, the body work, the somatic psychotherapies can really add to it.
And because we store stress many times in our bodies. This is why
sure.
A lot of times we have aches and pains, you know.
That's right.
You've got a sore neck or your back hurts,
why
you have
you get
a headache.
Your ulcer, yeah, all those things, that's right.
Yeah.
And so doing it together, I like the idea of keeping a psychologist or a psychiatrist on board and doing the work with the psychotherapy, but also adding the other dimension of the somatic work, the body work.
The trouble is nowadays if you go to a psychiatrist, they frequently just give you the drugs.
Well, that's right. That's the point. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Nowadays, people are getting so many of these scans, you know, and sometimes it seems like they're overdone.
The CT scans and the MRI scans and the we're using PT. Lots of contrast media to try and see what the insides of organs look like and the insides of blood vessels look like.
And our main concern has been the radiation about, you know, having so many of these scans.
Sure, especially the CT scans.
But what about the contrast media? We don't normally talk about the contrast media, and the contrast media contains iodine.
Yeah.
And that can affect our thyroid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this contrast media is used with the CT scans and cardiac catheterization and so forth. And they're helpful for seeing the blood vessels if there's blocks or if there's cancer and things
uh-huh.
like that.
Yeah, they do a lot for that. That's why we use them.
But many people are allergic or they end up with kidney problems. But there are other things. What are some of the other things that can happen to people?
Well, I mean, you can have these anaphylactic reactions or other kinds of toxic reactions that occur when you inject the dye. The kidney problems are the biggest thing that I worry about, actually. Somewhere between 2 and 7% of people will have an allergic or a kidney damage from it. And people who are at particular risk for it are the elderly, people with asthma or heart disease or kidney disease or myeloma. Even the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, if you're taking them, will put you at an increased risk for having a side effect.
And most people are on those, even though we badmouth them all the time. Those are the drugs that we,
like Advil,
or Motrin
yeah.
and Advil, leave.
Yeah, those drugs should be off the market. If you really want to learn about the NSAIDs, go to our website at drsaputo.com. That's S-A-P-U-T-O, by the way, .com. And put in NSAIDs, and you will see probably 50 or 75 articles that come up that are all in audio and video that will explain to you why these drugs are so bad and why it's criminal, in our opinion, that we have a problem with all the complications of those NSAIDs. Anyway, there's a lot more to this, but it's time for Vicki's 2020 tips. So
and then we'll get back to it.
You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's final 2020 tip.
Well, I have about four rules to remember in life. And one of them is that money cannot buy happiness. Mm. But you know, it's more comfortable to cry in a Porsche than on a bicycle.
Oh, there you are.
If you help somebody when they're in trouble, you can be sure that they're going to remember when they're in trouble again.
Indeed.
Where are they going to go to?
Yeah, right. Back to you.
And many people are alive only because it's illegal to shoot them. And alcohol does not solve any problems. But then, neither does milk.
Jeez. Oh, you're ruthless, Vicki. Well, a little humor goes a long way.
Okay, some of the other problems that this contrast media can cause when you have these scans would be things like if you take a beta blocker, if you take a diabetic drug.
Yeah, it's called glucophage. That's right. And so these contrast media have advantages, and that's why we use them. If you want to see what the blood vessels of a tissue look like, this is going to highlight it because it's concentrated in the blood vessels, and then there's a contrast that's set up between the normal tissues and what's in the blood vessels. So you can see where there are blockages or ulcers or clots. It gives you a good view of that. If you're trying to screen for cancer, you know, cancers have a lot of tangled blood vessels in them. It's called neoangiogenesis, which means new blood vessel growth. You'll see that and often can make a diagnosis of cancer or at least be very suspicious of it if it lights up, if that area of tissue lights up as it would if there was a tumor there. So anytime we're doing an assessment in healthcare and we're doing a test to try and see if we've got a problem that needs to be investigated or treated in a way that's different if we had more information, these tests are beautiful, and that's why we do them. Years ago, you know, 40 years ago when I was in my training or just getting started in medicine, it was a whole lot different. We didn't have these tests, and we had a hard time trying to find out what to do about certain situations because we just weren't sure what it was. And when the CTs came out and the MRIs came out, this was big news. And it makes a big difference in how we practice medicine. These are stellar tests that we never would want to give away, but at the same time, we're doing way too many of them. We tend to rely on these tests instead of using our clinical judgment or doing other kinds of tests that might give us information that's just as good. And that's when we should start looking at things like, well, how much radiation does a CT scan have? How many of them do you have to do before you're apt to cause a cancer? And that number is about 1,200. So if you took 1,200 people and you gave them a CT scan, one of them come up with a cancer. Now that's, you know, one in 1,200. And so that's probably not going to be you. But to that one person that gets it, that's a big deal. And when you're looking at the contrast media that we use with those CT scans, which is iodinated contrast, they have side effects too. And so the point we're trying to make is you may need a CT scan. You may need the iodinated contrast material to make an important decision about how you're going to make a treatment. But don't be thinking necessarily that because it's toxic and it can cause some problems that you should never do them. But you should be careful about deciding when you're going to do it and when maybe you could get away with not doing it.
Well, and also this is good information for your doctor to know about this new study so that your doctor can monitor your thyroid function.
Well, yes, that's a yes and a no, too, because let's look at it this way. The amount of iodine you get, okay, in these doses is less than 20 milligrams. Now, that may cause hyperthyroidism in a few people. That's of a minor amount.
But some people get a lot of these tests.
Well, no, that's not enough because what I was saying is that the amount of hyperthyroidism you get is minor and the length of time that you'll have it will be limited. It's way less than what we were doing when the Fukushima incident happened, that nuclear reactor that blew, okay, in Japan, or the number of them that blew in Japan. We're all wanting to have a raid on the SSKI, the saturated solution of potassium iodide, or iodine tablets or capsules of some type, because we didn't want to get thyroid cancer from it, not keeping in mind that those doses were causing lots of problems, as it turns out, with hyperthyroidism and some even with hypothyroidism, because it can work either way. So, yes, we're doing a little bit of a tirade on iodinated contrast media because we should point out that there are dangers that can come from it, and it's new information that we know now because the clinical study has been done to show that, yeah, you can get a touch of hyperthyroidism from it. And how many people get it, what percentage, that would be low. So the point of this particular article, or bringing it up, is that you may want to ask your doctor, do we really need to do this test? Is there another way we could go about studying it? Should we do an ultrasound instead, which is a non-invasive approach? Or should we do an MRI without using the gadolinium, which has got its problems as well, because it can cause kidney disease that can be fatal, actually. It can cause fibrosis of the kidney.
I just think it would be good to just go over briefly what the symptoms are of hypo and hyperthyroidism. Because with hyperthyroidism, people tend to have a faster metabolism.
Their heart rate goes up. Their blood pressure goes up. They can have a fine tremor. They tend to be hot. They tend to get looser bowels. They get agitated easier. They're more apt to be excitable. Those are the things you see with hyperthyroidism. I don't think you would see those things in people who took iodinated contrast media, even if they had minor effects temporarily of hyperthyroidism.
And hypo is pretty much the opposite. People that don't have as much energy that tend to be overweight and have dry skin and a slower heart
sluggish.
Rate.
And your mind doesn't work.
So the main point here is that we take these tests for granted as being safe, and all drugs have side effects, and this is a drug.
Yeah, well, it's something to keep in mind. What you want is a physician who has judgment, who has experience, who's seen some of these things happen, and know when to do what. It's all about experience and good judgment. So it's not like I'm trying to, or Vicky's trying to come down on the people who are doing CT scans and MRIs and using the contrast media. It's just that we should use our common sense and know when to do what. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicky. The number is 888-874-4888.
So what's all this about stem cells helping heart attack victims? Let's talk about what stem cells are and where they come from and how we can use them and about this study.
Yeah, this is great. You know, we're doing a little mainstream medicine today, which I like to throw in there because, you know, a lot of people think that, yeah, here's a doctor who really understands medicine and he thinks it sucks and that we should never do it. But that's the furthest thing from the truth.
Well, we believe in integrative medicine, so yeah, considering all the different types of...
Well, again, it's knowing when to do what, and that takes judgment. And when you've been a doctor for a lot of years, you know, 40 years, and you've spent 30 plus of those years in the ICU and the CCU and doing a large inpatient practice, you get a feel for where medicine's good and where it can really help and do a lot of incredible high-tech things that save lives and prevent a lot of disability. And medicine absolutely does that. But it also causes problems, and it will never be primary care because it's not about wellness and prevention and nutritional and natural therapies. It's about invasive things. It's about using technologies and drugs that can have lots of side effects and problems, and you need to know when to do what. So when you go to your naturopath, you're going to get great stuff that has to do with nutrition and natural therapies and good ways to treat people who have conditions that are a problem. But you're not going to get the same thing if there's a lot going wrong there because they just don't have the same experience. They have some, but they don't have the same experience that a medical doctor does. But so it works both ways.
And medicine also causes a lot of complications.
Well, that's
and
the
deaths.
Point. And that's why we need naturopaths. So there's a whole order to, in my mind, to how we go about treating people just treating people, period. And what I like to do is always start with lifestyle medicine. Because I think it's a beautiful way to keep people from getting sick and from needing the things that might be using these iodated contrasts that you maybe wish you didn't have to or some other treatments that are dangerous. So that's first. Second, then you use non-invasive therapies. You see your naturopath or your Chinese medicine doctor or somebody does Ayurveda or Native American medicine. Yeah, or chiropractors. Yeah, there are lots of ways to go there. And if that doesn't work, then start getting aggressive. You know, start using herbs and supplements and nutrients,
really
which
aggressive.
Can cause problems too, but thousands of times less dangerous than medicines. And if that doesn't work, then, you know, go to your doctor and do what is possible to do in medicine that can be aggressive, that takes a lot of judgment. So that's the system. Now back to the stem cells. That's where we started. Stem cells, really, there are two different types. I'm just going to give you a quick background on what they are and why we need to know about them. We're looking at two types of stem cells, the embryonic ones that come from those baby embryos that there's a lot of controversy going about because of the ideas, are we killing human beings?
Can't we get it from umbilical cords, too?
You can, but they're not quite the same. I'll get to that in a minute. There are a lot of different ways that we can get adult stem cells. And so what we have here is stem cells that can be adult as well, and they can differentiate into 200 different kinds of human cells, which is amazing. Then there are three sources of adult stem cells, from the bone marrow, from fat tissue of all things.
That's really interesting.
And from
one
blood.
Way to get rid of your fat.
Yeah. You can also get it from the umbilical cord, as you were saying, and also from bone marrow transplantation, which we're doing for a lot of cancers.
And from blood,
days.
Too. Can't you get it from blood?
Yeah, I said that. That's
oh,
right.
Missed
from
that.
Blood, too. So those are the ways that you get it. That's a little about the stem cells. Now, in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, this last a couple of weeks, an article came out talking about that you could use adult stem cells derived from your fat, your own fat, to try and treat people, okay, who've had an acute heart attack.
So go get a little liposuction.
Well, a little liposuction.
Fix your heart.
And see if you get those stem cells out of there. And when you do, a lot of good things happen. They found that the procedure was safe in the acute setting. There were no side effects. There were no rhythm disturbances. There was an improvement in cardiac function by SPECT scanning. There was more blood flow, and there was less scar tissue. So what we're looking at is in a setting of acute heart attack that you can really make people do an awful lot better in their clinical outcome if you do that.
So what exactly is a stem cell that it can do all this?
Well, these are the primordial cells, okay, the original cells that come from the embryo as it's developing. And they have to have the potential to develop into 200 different cell types. So those cells have the potential of doing that. Whereas a fat cell makes more fat cells, and the nerve cell makes more nerve cells, and the muscle cell makes more muscle cells.
So a stem cell makes 200 other kinds of...
They have the potential to do that, so they call them pluripotential. Uh-huh. I mean, they can do lots of things. And so we inject about 20 million of these cells that we culture after we get them, and then inject them into the bloodstream or into the heart, and we get this better function. So we get a 50% smaller infarct, there's less of a perfusion defect, and the heart can pump much better.
So we don't have to get them from babies.
No. Well, no, we don't have to get them. Well, the best way still is from embryos. And we have to make decisions.
Isn't they're fresher, is that it?
Well, no, they're just younger, and they have the potential to do more things than a cell that's much older. The more a cell has been around, and the more differentiated it becomes, which means declares what it's going to be doing in terms of its cell type, the more it does that, then the less potential it has to do other things. Now, we have a lot to learn about that, and bringing it forward in clinical practice, of course, there's a huge demand for it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to turn out good. I mean, we know that some babies, little embryos, turn into what are called teratomas, where they have these cancerous things that the baby isn't born except as a mass of funny cells.
Yeah.
So the question is, can we do that? And the answer is yes, it can. So in this country, we're being careful about how we use stem cell therapy. And it's why a lot of people who are desperate are going to other countries to have it done. So the stem cells are a beautiful thing in theory. And the question is how are we going to do in terms of bringing that forward into clinical practice so that it's safe and it does the things that we want it to do, because its potential is enormous. We might be able to treat cancers that way. And to treat people with Parkinson's disease and ALS and all kinds of neurological deficiencies. I mean, the potential for stem cell therapy is just stunning. So I'm inclined to want to see medicine continue to progress along these lines, where we're doing a lot of research and seeing what happens. The same thing with gene therapy. You know, we can actually change the DNA of people by adding DNA that has the missing enzymes or can produce the missing enzymes that cause certain diseases. It's a huge thing. And it also leads us back to the whole topic of epigenetics.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about how we live our life can affect what our genes, what our DNA is like.
So we don't have to just accept that we've inherited a tendency to something.
It depends on what it is.
Uh-huh.
See, if you have a genetic defect to develop diabetes, you may or may not develop that diabetes, or heart attack, you may or may not, depending on what environment you live in. If you live in a healthy environment that is creating a situation that is going to make the genes develop in a way that's safe for you and to protect you.
And you live a healthy lifestyle.
Yeah, so if you're leading a healthy lifestyle, that's going to happen. And if you don't, and you lead in a way where it's a problem, then you may have an issue that's a whole lot different. You may have something that leads to making those oncogenes, those cancer genes, all of a sudden become active. You know, Dean Ornish did some beautiful work on men who had early stage prostate cancer about a year or so ago. Maybe it was 2 years ago now. And what he did is he took people who had the Gleason 6 cancers, which are ones that you can watch and wait fairly safely and what most urologists are recommending. And he biopsied all those 300 people who had Gleason 6 prostate cancer, and measured 500 oncogenes to see if they were turned on or turned off. Turned on to cause cancer or turned off to not cause cancer. And in all those patients, for the most part, those genes were turned on and they were making cancer. Well, he waited 3 months, and in one group he did nothing, and he re-biopsied them again, and the same 500 oncogenes were still turned on. Okay, so there was no change. In the other group, they gave them a healthy diet. They exercised them, they did meditation, yoga, the kinds of things that make people feel good and living a healthy lifestyle. And then he remeasured those oncogenes again, and he found that the bulk of them were turned off.
Isn't that wonderful?
So what you know from that experience is that, does your lifestyle matter in a major way? Can it actually alter how your DNA expresses itself? The answer is yes. So the DNA, yeah, it's like a blueprint, but it's not fixed. And it's not the player that's the biggest player.
So don't just give up and accept that you have bad genes and you're going to die from a heart attack or diabetes or whatever else it happens to be. Well, live a healthy lifestyle, huh?
Yes, it'll help some. But in some ways, don't get overly confident that you can do the things you've done your whole life and then you're going to change your lifestyle around and everything is going to be fine. You wind up with a cancer of your brain or your kidney or your pancreas. That's bad news. Now, there's no two ways about that. And I don't care what epigenetics you do, there are none that we know of up to this point in time that are going to make much of a difference, okay, much of a difference in what happens in that cancer. It's probably still going to do you in. So there's a good reason for cleaning up our environment and getting those environmental toxins out of our lives so that we don't have exposure to them and all the risks that go with it. That's huge. And it's also important to eat right and make sure you're getting all the nutrients you need so your body can make all the protective things it needs to protect us.
And get enough sleep so your body has a chance to repair itself.
Well, that's right. So it needs to be able to do that. And you need, like you said, sleep. You need stress reduction. You need to weigh what you should. You need to have a life that has meaningful purpose. And if you'll do all those things, the chances of your doing well are going to get huge. They're going to get much better. So lifestyle has a powerful effect. What we're exposed to in our lives has a powerful effect. So we're not just stuck. We're able. We need to do the things that that our bodies need to do to protect us. So I'd like to remind you that we're back to talk live about what's new in the news in health and to take your health questions next Monday at the same time. And remind you that we are archiving the show on drsaputo.com as well as prn.fm.
And if you've enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, you can go to drsaputo.com and check out our fast track videos. So remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. If you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
And have a wonderful week. We'll see you next week.